The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
While we're continuing our week of coverage of the Women's Memorial March, yesterday we heard from previous year's speeches as well as the case of a woman who went missing in the downtown east side but has since been found thanks to community effort. Today, we're going to air an interview with Juanita Desjarlais. She's a member of the Women's Memorial March Committee, and she was interviewed by my co-host on The Pulse on CFRO, Macy Tan.
What a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Juanita, can I ask you to introduce yourself and the role that you're playing with the march this year?
My traditional name is Sinte Sapatawea, and my paper name is Juanita Desjarlais. And I am an active committee member for the February 14th Memorial March Planning Committee. And I have been an active member serving on the committee probably for the past 14 or 15 years. And each year we gather to organize. So there's a multitude of family members, community members, advocates, that gather to organize the event.
I understand it's the 30th anniversary of the march this year.
That's a long time.
I'm just thankful for the committee and for the community to for having put this event on for 30 years, for having put a march on for 30 years. But at the same time, another part of me thinks, I wish that we wouldn't need to have this march for such a long time.
With that, initially, what happened was is that a woman, I can't share her name out of respect for the family. But what happened was is the woman was found murdered down by the sugar refinery. And there were, you know, body parts strewn carelessly. And just, you know, it just shows the brutality. And it's just horrendous and outrageous, and the lack of police response. And so what happened was is the community and the family, you know, they were outraged by the lack of police response, and they decided to gather, you know, and raise awareness and, you know, show their outrage and, you know, highlight, you know, their family member, but also, you know, other missing and murdered Indigenous women, and the lack of response and care from the RCMP and the Vancouver Police Department. So what's evolved over time is each year our Indigenous women, especially in the downtown east side, face higher rates of violence than, well, a lot of communities also experience that as well, but this is pertaining to the downtown east side. And we have higher rates of incarceration for Indigenous women. We also have higher rates of, you know, health issues pertaining to Indigenous women and higher rates of violence. And women are always, Indigenous women are always at the center of, you know, predators, you know, exploiting them in whatever aspect, whether that's in the drug market or, you know, in the field of, you know, exploitation, like sexual exploitation. Our women have been groomed sexually and are targeted from a young age. And this has been part of history after the point of contact from the colonizers and the missionaries. And the colonizers introduced violence and the missionaries introduced sexual violence. So the combination, you know, of both has increased the rate of violence and sexual violence against Indigenous women. and also the introduction of man camps. And that comes from the time of the railroads and the building of the highways, and also from the gold rush era. So this timeline connects, you know, to the history, and also after point of contact, you know, when the colonizers, you know, would take and the missionaries would take children and teenagers and women from their communities, either by force or they were taken as slaves. And this these behaviors have continued by their predecessors, meaning their family members, passed down from generation to generation, which has become an epidemic now and has infiltrated, you know, throughout the institutions, and like primarily, you know, the hospitals and the RCMP and the Vancouver Police Department, and you know, and throughout the institutions, right? And so we look at, you know, other additional things such as racism, discrimination, you know, biasness, and basically what exists is, you know, that footprint from the colonizers and the missionaries, and how that's deep rooted today and impacts our people, our families, and our Indigenous women.
I think a lot of folks don't connect it to the fact that it's happening to girls and women in our city, in our neighborhood, in the community we live in. And I think also particularly that folks don't think about the structural causes of this violence. And I wonder if there's more light you can shed on folks who maybe are just trying to learn more about the topic.
Well, I think what a lot of people don't fully understand is that, you know, since the point of contact, like around the time of, what was it, 1492, when the colonizers, you know, first approached upon the land and the people of the land, is that right from the onset, you know, the colonizers viewed our people, and their descriptions of us, you know, were very insulting. They were very derogatory. They were very criticizing, judgmental, and discriminatory and racist. And so when we look back over the years, and we look at, you know, we as Indigenous people, we talk about intergenerational abuse, or we talk about intergenerational effects or impacts. Well, not only do we identify, you know, because we're going forward with healing now, we not only identify that, yes, we are suffering, you know, and we are at the same time, you know, healing. And we look at the colonizers and their relatives over history and over time. We look at the colonizers and the missionaries and the Catholic Church and their views on two-spirited people. And it's been racist and discriminatory there as well. Whereas in our culture, it's the total opposite. You know, they were of high respect because of their ability to be able to identify with both the male and female aspect within one. And not only that, you know, they're gifted people. And there are a lot of teachings around that. And a lot of, you know, that sacredness of our two-spirited have experienced that discrimination and racism. And people were and still are subjected, you know, to those judgmental and racist views. Because when we look at other ethnicities around the world that follow the Catholic Church, those are very high numbers, right? And with the views that they have pertaining, you know, to the scriptures and how they communicate around somebody being two-spirited, they're very harmful. They're very hurtful. And so a lot of those behaviors and words and ways of being are carried forward to their own children. So when we look back to the time, to the point of contact till today, that's thousands of years of violence, racism, and discrimination against our women, our children, our two-spirited community, and our men. And what society doesn't fully understand is the devastating impacts upon our people. We've experienced a lot of trauma at the hands of the colonizers and the missionaries, the Catholic, you know, influence to eliminate our language, to eliminate our traditional ways. And they wanted to indoctrinate us. What they did was they committed genocide against us. And it still continues today through their language of racism and discrimination and the violence that our people experience on a daily basis. And it pertains to both sexes now, or to all genders or non-genders and nations of Indigenous First Nations peoples. And so when we look at that history, and the people are starting to understand and identify that they are healing from these thousands of years of trauma and violence. And then we look at the Westernized community of people. What are they doing, you know, to change that? It's all about individuality and challenging, you know, growth within yourself. We look at the white supremacy groups, you know, and their families, and people aren't talking about that as much as they should be, how that's infiltrated all across, you know, Turtle Island, which that description means, you know, North America. So Canada and the United States, right? That's an epidemic, and they influence their children and each other to invoke violence and sexual violence against Indigenous peoples because of, I don't know, I say it's a sickness. It's a sickness that they carry, that they've carried from their predecessors, meaning, you know, the original colonizers and the original missionaries. And they've done is they've brainwashed to continue, you know, these behaviors on and to justify their behaviors, in a sense, which creates a huge epidemic. I would like to see more focus on that as to what individuals are doing, you know, to promote, I won't say, well, in part justice, but at the same time to promote change within their own family systems. So when we look at the rates of sexual violence that have occurred against Indigenous girls, Indigenous youth, and women and boys, well, those colonizers and those ones carrying on with those behaviors are more than likely to be committing those crimes to their own families as well, which creates a higher epidemic of violence and sexual violence and grooming. And all of that, you know, continues on to a bigger picture like human trafficking, right? And so what have we learned over the years, you know, and how do we promote change within our own family circles? How do we promote change, you know, in our communities? We need to work at being well. All nations of people need to work at being well.
Thank you for that. And thank you for sharing, because I know that takes energy. And I want to apologize as well, because one thing I think about in my role as a journalist is that I have to, I'm trying to invite people to share. But I also know it takes a lot of work and emotional energy. So I want to say thank you. And I also apologize at the same time.
Oh, that's okay. I usually have a smudge going. And so that just, you know, like I've been doing this work and I do a lot of work on myself culturally and spiritually. So I, you know, I take care of myself like that. And then if something is triggered for me, then I, you know, I call and I talk to, you know, like one of my elders, like my teachers or another sister.
I'd love to get your thoughts. One thing I heard from my community is that folks have never been to a march like this or an event like this and don't really know how to act. Could you offer some words of advice for folks who maybe are feeling that way?
I think that it's really awesome, you know, that people are showing an interest to support. You don't have to have someone, you know, that has been murdered or missing to attend. I think by showing up and showing your support is so meaningful, you know, to the families and to the friends and family members as well. One of the things that we always encourage is, you know, is that this is, this particular march is honoring the lives lost, you know, in the downtown East Side. And, you know, as we know, sharing is caring, right? And so we ask that nobody wear, you know, any colors or affiliations like with any other like groups or, you know, gangs or whatever, you know, things like that. This year there is definitely going to be safety protocols in place. So there will be sanitizer and masks handed out. Social distancing is a big factor as well. The event is going to be held outside as well. The event will also be live streamed. So you can check that out on the February 14th Memorial March page on Facebook, on the internet. So there will be a link there as well. And I'm sure there will be, you know, lots of people sharing as well. So if you are curious, you know, I encourage you to either tune in. So the first event in the morning will be for families only, because this is a memorial for us to show our love, care, and support for the families, because every year, you know, it when we lose a loved one or recently, you know, lose a loved one, it's so important to be able to connect with others, you know, who share similar experience, and to show the love. And what we can share with each other about our loss and about the emotional aspect, and also about the bureaucratic aspect, you know, with the police departments, and you just really get a lot of support and a lot of love, and that's what it's about. That's what it's about. It's also about raising the awareness, you know, about how this is an epidemic. What is, you know, what are people doing this year alone? You know, I've heard on the media about how women or people have been subjected to violence because of COVID, and they are detached from interfering. People aren't helping. And that's really scary when you think about how many women are being assaulted in their homes, in front of their children, out in broad daylight, and nobody is doing anything. We need to start caring for the people, caring about each other, not just when it happens in our own backyard, and caring about human life, no matter what. So if you see somebody who's laying on the ground, checking on them to see whether they're breathing or they're alive.
Juanita, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that was Juanita Desjarlais of the Women's Memorial March Committee, interviewed by our co-host here on The Pulse on CFRO, Macy Tan. The march will be held this Sunday at noon at Main and Hastings outside the Carnegie Center. People are asked to wear face masks and to socially distance. And we will be there with The Pulse on CFRO to bring you audio the next day in case you missed it. You can also follow our live tweets on Twitter at CFRO The Pulse.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.